In October, the International Bar Association will publish a book tentatively entitled Key Issues in Communications, Media, and Telecom Sectors, in conjunction with their annual conference to take place this year in Tokyo, Japan. I'm proud to have an article entitled The Role of Privacy in a Changing World to be included in that publication. What you'll hear next and over the next 2 weeks is an abbreviated sneak peek at this article, which I hope will spur your interest in the publication, the work of the bar in this area, and the many excellent authors taking part. In October 2013, I was interviewed for an article that appeared in the Christian Science Monitor. The topic was the NSA surveillance revelations and their potential impact on U.S.-European Union trade and other key negotiations. A friend of mine had been forwarded a copy of my remarks and emailed me with the following kernel of resignation. Our privacies once enjoyed are a thing of the past. Now, I've heard variations on this theme for many years, even more, of course, within the past year. In May of 2013, Judge Richard Posner of the Second Circuit wrote an editorial for the New York Daily News calling privacy overrated. His core theme, that privacy and security are in constant balance against one another, is very sound, even if his enthusiasm for security to be ever favored in the balance might today be seen as understandable pre-NSA revelations exuberance. An August 12, 2013 article in Time magazine, highlighting that privacy is illusory just days after the NSA audit reports on privacy violations were made public, was less excusable. It reminded me of the old Monty Python sketch, the British policeman standing in the midst of a melee, holding a bullhorn and calmly imploring, "Please disperse, there is nothing to see here." In late November 2013, at the U.S. Federal Trade Commission's forum on the Internet of Things, a long-awaited discussion on the swirl of issues brought about by the prospect of connecting everyday devices, cars, power, etc. to the Internet, a remark was made that privacy may actually be an anomaly, if not a product of our modern industrial age. The speaker described a time when people lived in small villages and everyone knew everyone else's business. When we began moving into cities, he argued, we developed anonymity as a byproduct of urbanization. What is privacy? And why is the view of privacy's lessening relevance in the information age simply not credible? Let's start by first debunking the notion that privacy is of modern origin. Regardless of whether you are a Christian, it probably would not surprise you to learn that the authors of the book of Genesis, in the 1st to 2nd century AD, were interpreting already age-old stories and legends passed down from generations earlier. Thus, it's also likely not surprising that when Adam and Eve in Genesis chapter 3, verses 8 and 9 are suddenly aware of their nakedness and reach for leaves to construct a bit of privacy, the authors make no reference to an app for that. The notion of what is privacy may be nebulous, but its function in society is not. On Tuesday, December 4th, 2013, the White House's Nicole Wong, Deputy Chief Technology Officer, made what was for her a rare set of remarks at a practical privacy meeting of the International Association of Privacy Professionals in Washington. In her remarks, Ms. Wong cited the late privacy scholar Alan Weston's premise that privacy itself is not an end state, but that the end state is freedom of expression, with privacy as a means to that end. This reference to Weston's seminal writings is spot on, but there is much more to what he said. Weston was speaking here to one of three facets to privacy: informational privacy. The second facet for Weston, territorial privacy, refers to the ability to control the information that enters and leaves one's personal sphere. And finally, privacy of the person describes a person's right to be protected against undue interference of a physical nature. For instance, why issues of birth control, abortion, commitment proceedings are all typically framed as privacy issues. Weston wrote that informational privacy is the claim of individuals, groups, and institutions to determine for themselves when, how, and to what extent information about them is communicated to others. Freedom of expression, though critical and particularly in the context of the U.S. Bill of Rights, is only one part of the equation. To use an analogy, Adam and Eve, when they decided to cover their nether regions with leaves, were not likely doing so with the aim to make a statement, but rather to not make one. To say nothing and not have that nothing by itself interpreted as expression is just as vital, But this form of protection requires communal action, or standards to blunt whatever interpretive value might be drawn from daily lives. To use the example I mentioned earlier, from the FTC's Internet of Things form, but in a way turn it on its head, when a late Victorian tight-knit Italian or Jewish community in New York City may have decided to look the other way when the local priest or rabbi would regularly imbibe too much on a Friday night, they were creating privacy by social construct. When various cultures and ethnic groups urbanized, privacy was hardly thrown to the wind. It was often even more fervently guarded as a critical maintenance of culture. Similarly, when any set of neighbors lives in close proximity long enough, watch programs develop, block parties can happen, but also the occasional harmless indiscretion of a neighbor's child can be winked at. This is society creating a sense of dignity, the state or quality of being worthy of respect. This is human. Privacy is dignity. For so much of our early U.S. history, the maintenance of privacy as a bulwark of dignity was very much driven by our religious and ethnic socialization. The social standards of what was private were embedded in immigrant traditions from Western and Eastern Europe, Africa, Asia, and then Central and South America. These traditions were carried like a comfortable blanket from home and into growing communities of like-minded and like-empowered homogeneous peoples. Even in the close confines of East Harlem, proximity did not blot out privacy. To the contrary, a sense of dignity required it. As these communities dispersed, the maintenance of dignity through privacy became rooted in far more practical concerns. Even today, as Rosa Brooks wrote so well in Foreign Affairs in late 2013, we're most often concerned with very concrete kinds of economic and physical harm, from social stigma to job loss to theft, injury, imprisonment, or death, and not an often nebulous vision of what is or isn't private. Privacy, in the context of these concerns, supports dignity as a defense against the harms that can flow from power, its uses and abuses. We fear that we'll end up on a no-fly list, or be unable to get a security clearance, a job, or a loan. From a neighbor using our past as leverage, to a thief knowing where we keep our jewelry, to a government seeking to curtail dissent, or worse, what frightens us most is the very concrete possibility that information about us, however it is gleaned, will be misconstrued, misused, or abused. Individuals began to look more often to the law for maintenance of dignity through privacy. Indeed, the greatest growth in U.S. case law on issues of privacy occurred in the periods following late 1800s industrialization and post-World War II, times of great movement, resettlement, and technological development. The Internet and the advance of the information age, while welcomed for all that will do for economic growth, education, and global communications, has also exacerbated the gap between concrete fears regarding data misuse and the maintenance of dignity through privacy that had once been the domain of cultural and religious traditions. Last week's segment focused on the historical and sociological underpinnings of privacy and the extent to which these have been addressed in law and why. This week's segment is entitled, Has Law Bridged the Gap? Assuming that we know what the gap is. Omer Tenney, Vice President of Research and Education to the International Association of Privacy Professionals, wrote a fascinating blog in March 2014 on the comparison of European and U.S. privacy environments. His primary point was that where the U.S. regime may be lacking in depth and omnibus-type issue coverage, tremendous growth in the practical abilities of privacy professionals have made the U.S. address of privacy issues far more activist and effective. What the U.S. privacy practice has learned particularly well in the past 5 years is to exploit trigger words underlying privacy-related concerns, secrecy, hypocrisy, deception, and unfairness. While the public and press may not really understand what privacy is, a lack of understanding that many have used effectively to advocate in action, these individual pulses within privacy are readily relatable. This activism and practitioner abilities are admirable. It is why we are here today having this conversation. But to continually throw incredibly competent soldiers into the breach will not, in this case, cure the breach. It is impossible, of course, to possess total privacy. Neighbors can peek through our windows. Strangers in public places or waiting rooms may see us in the context of what some might call the fine art of people watching. Patrons in cafes can listen to our conversations and telephone calls, and anyone can Google us. And these are examples that are nothing compared to the data compiled about us by marketers and data brokers. For the most part, this doesn't trouble us, and we simply accept that is the price of living among humanity in an information age. And yet, it's one thing to know that anyone can see into your kitchen through the window, but another thing altogether to discover someone staring fixedly at you. This triggers not only Weston's notion of territorial privacy, or the ability to control the information that enters and leaves our personal sphere, but also brings applicable harms to the fore. The man staring fixedly through our kitchen window bothers us not because we think he might discover us doing something secret, but because he has violated norms of socially acceptable behavior, in a way that not only makes him unpredictable, but also will likely cow our own behaviors in what we thought was a safe environment. Peeping Tom laws have been created to address such fears. And similarly, statutes and case law have developed to prohibit the observation of us without our consent in private spaces or in homes, by strangers, spouses, or significant others. His violation of these norms of acceptable behavior begs the question, will the person be a blackmailer, a thief, a rapist, or a murderer, or will the actions merely represent an unacceptable lapse in judgment? Regardless of how these questions play out, the impacts are very real. At what point does our data profile and how it may be used to reach the point where it equates to the man staring fixedly at us through the window, albeit the window of our laptop? The data can be as innocuous as the empty header to an email message containing the message Happy Friday, or as fleeting as a timestamp indicating when we last visited Amazon.com. But combine the many thousands of these data points, often referred to as metadata, with knowledge of who we are, where we live, and our buying habits. Add in other types of media content, such as pictures, digital recordings, and video. At some point in the combination process, and it may in fact be very early, a picture begins to form, one that is far more territorial than merely informational, in Weston's sense, and one that is far more revealing than the very limited amount of data the U.S. Supreme Court considered in its 1979 precedent in U.S. v. Maryland, a precedent that is often analogized by law enforcement to today's information environment. Data brokers, for instance, are increasingly aggregating data about us from numerous sources into ever more specialized lists. The lists, which are typically sold to marketers, presume to cover very sensitive topics regarding the data targets, including gay and lesbian adults, people suffering from bipolar disorder, people with alcohol, sexual, and gambling addictions, and people who have purchased adult material and sex toys. Currently, data brokers are required by federal law in the U.S. to maintain the privacy of a consumer's data only if it is used for credit, employment, insurance, or housing purposes. Medical records and prescription purchases are off-limits too, but data brokers are allowed to track purchases of over-the-counter drugs and other related medical items to gather a health profile on the data subject. Even if we are to consider the more restrictive route of requiring consent from a data subject, as in the context of the EU Data Protection Directive, there remains the problem highlighted by Mark Rotenberg. How do you consent to the disclosure of your information if you don't know which of your information is being disclosed, to whom and for what purpose? This last question, for what purpose, is a big one. For even if we are to set aside for a moment the fact that the highly sensitive data in many of these lists is itself an issue, the conclusions drawn by the list makers may bear little resemblance to reality. Just because a metric is easy to capture doesn't mean it's the right one to use. Ken Kukier and Victor Mayer Schoenberger write in their most recent book, Big Data, A Revolution, that causality is nice when you can get it. But the problem is that it's often hard to get, and even when we think we've found it, we're often deluding ourselves. Seeing causality, where it truly doesn't exist in any real or even slightly credible form, is the real downside of an over-reliance on big data analytics alone. For instance, there is an increasing value in what's called data exhaust, or the data that is shed as a byproduct of action or inaction. However, most that see value in measuring a negative i.e. I didn't press X or opt out, would tell you that to assign any direct meaning to the inaction is almost never correct. As Daniel Solov wrote in a terrific article in January 2014 entitled 10 Reasons Why Privacy Matters, even in the offline world, knowing the private details about people's lives doesn't necessarily lead to more accurate judgment about people. People judge badly. They judge in haste. They judge out of context. They judge without hearing the whole story, and they judge with hypocrisy, wrote Daniel Solov. Kukier and Schoenberger caution that big data is likely to provide the temptation to judge on the basis of propensity, a temptation that society must be careful to squelch. And this is particularly true if the propensity-based decision-making at issue influences choices or options of the data subject, or worse, impacts their reputation, health, or livelihood. Now, this is not to say that the data portrait we might have of us, our lives, and our behaviors cannot be incredibly rewarding. As I wrote in September 2013, companies must keep their focus on customer and customer choice. If they do this, I believe there is little fear in the short term that a loss of trust among certain national actors will somehow translate to the consumer and damage confidence in consensual services and digital innovations. And if the company is a step removed from the customer, as in the case of many data brokers, something needs to come into play to facilitate that trust. In my podcasts in late July and early August of 2013, I spoke of the many companies in the big data analytics space, for example, that are doing their ablest to find the sweet spot between the killer app and the creepy app. Much of this effort is growing in the context of predictive search, advertising, and applications. Anticipatory computing and other artificial intelligence, systems that learn to predict what you need before you ask, may not be for everyone, but they will be, and in a limited sense already are, for some of us. There is no doubt, as European Commission Vice President Neelie Kroes said in March 2014, that the next phase of the Internet will be data-centered and connectivity-driven. Cloud computing, big data, the Internet of Things, tools which support manufacturing, education, energy, our cars, and more. However, to make this leap of faith into this new world, as she puts it, reliability and trust is a precondition, she said. In the absence of a law that establishes when data collection and analysis equates to staring fixedly at us through our computer, and recognizes and protects highly sensitive categories of data, erosion in the economics of trust will become an ever more measurable reality. Erosion in the economics of trust is best represented as the moment when a lack of comfort, either in transparency or follow-through by an industry or government, translates to accelerating decisions by a consumer not to press send, purchase, or I agree. Last week's segment focused on the question, has law bridged the gap, assuming that we know what the gap is? This week, the sea change in the role of trust, and where do we go from here? When I wrote in January 2013 that the EU-US privacy relationship had several fundamental stumbling blocks despite many mutual goals, I did not expect that investigative measures would be the one stumbling block to soon dominate the news. From former NSA contractor Edward Snowden's first notices of a bulk telephone metadata database to more recent revelations, the breadth of surreptitiously collected information, most of it swept up and warehoused without a trigger of investigative purpose, is staggering. For a time after June 5th, I tried to see things from the perspective of some in Congress who, despite the waves of revelations, seemed conflicted with regard to what should be done. We don't see the oppression of a virtual invasion of privacy very much, and you cannot hold up a picture of someone being electronically spied on. Even worse, you cannot immediately illustrate the psychic damage and cowed sensibilities that come with the fear of being spied on. And to attempt a clinical observation of the long-term effects of surveillance or social manipulation would be morally repugnant, rendering the subject little more than a human toy. In reality, of course, none of us who have ever been remotely engaged on the issues of security and privacy had until June 5, 2013, been living in a state of blissful naivety. Many of us assumed that in some way, shape, or form, we were being surveilled for purposes of national security. The issue, though, is the degree to which the need for intelligence have, since 9/11, progressively weighed far more heavily in the balance with privacy and civil rights. For better or worse, I spent a greater part of the 9 months after June 5th writing, speaking, and providing commentary on issues relating to the surveillance revelations. My analysis of the legal issues is best left to other texts, particularly a speech I gave at the International Bar Association conference in Boston in October 2013. Suffice it to say that the same many of us who presumed some measure of surveillance as a necessity also assumed that there would be far greater limits, audits to show justifications, and oversight. We need only look to two reports issued in December 2013 and January 2014 from the President's Review Group on Intelligence Communication Technologies and the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, respectively, to know that we were wrong. For instance, the PCLOB determined that the mass surveillance program was not only ineffective, but also had no basis in law. It also found that the program had never stopped even a single imminent terrorist attack. For the many millions in resources that have been spent on collecting at all and developing technologies to parse the minutiae of so many daily lives, what are we missing? And are there fewer traditional intelligence investigations running down real leads? And what have been the economic trade-offs? By early August 2013, the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation had published a brief outlining potential impacts to the U.S. cloud computing industry. Out of a global enterprise cloud computing market of $207 billion, IDIF suggests that by 2016, U.S. cloud providers could stand to lose $35 billion. Technology commentator James Staton analyzed the ITEF efforts and found them excellent, but perhaps underplaying the impact, suggesting that the loss could be as great as $180 billion, or a 25% hit to overall IT service provider revenues in the same time frame. Still others are trying to take the pulse of broader consumer concerns, with one outlet reporting in mid-August 2013 that only 7 weeks of post-Snowden media coverage had the percentage of internet users reporting concerns about their privacy online jump from 48 to 67%. Where do we go from here? More recently, I've seen some take the view that privacy is less dead than a victim of circumstance, run over by the unstoppable train of data use and collection that is riding the rails of humanity's hunger for information and the need to know more. The gotta-have-it view seems too dystopian a rationale for the much-needed revisiting of key privacy compliance concepts such as the nature and quality of consent and a more dynamic view of when it's required. We need to give the advance of big data and all of its potential benefits, and certainly the consumer, far more credit. Only 5 years ago, I remember briefing a member of the UK Parliament on the Internet of Things, who, though very tech-savvy, drolly remarked that, "If my refrigerator could tweet, I'm not sure that I would want to see what it said." In 5 years, we've come a long way. In a speech at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs, Commissioner Julie Brill of the U.S. Federal Trade Commission highlighted that just some of the many ways in which the cloud, big data, and analytics are beginning to change our lives in profound and beneficial ways. By addressing important societal issues like keeping kids in school, conserving our national resources by making our use of electricity more efficient, providing first responders in crisis situations with real-time information about the injured or those who lack power, water, or food, and performing other miracles in the healthcare sector. Indeed, the opportunities for big data analytics may provide in the field of medicine some staggering results. I agree with Daniel Weitzner, former Deputy White House Chief Technology Officer for Internet Policy and now Director of the MIT CSAIL, Decentralized Information Group, who recently noted in an interview that there is a tendency in the U.S. to believe that you can only have privacy if you have secrecy. That if a third party holds your information, then somehow you've lost all your privacy. This is in part an outgrowth of the 1967 decision of the Supreme Court in Katz v. U.S. In Katz, John Marshall Harlan's concurring opinion established the reasonable expectation of privacy test, which contains a subjective component, the actual expectation of privacy, and an objective component, the reasonable expectation of privacy. It was the objective element that has had the unfortunate distinction evolving into what has become known as the third-party doctrine in the U.S., by which one diminishes or even loses an expectation of privacy through voluntary turnover of data to a third party. Increasingly, it is the quality of voluntarism that is the key component of the doctrine. As Mr. Weitzer notes, protecting privacy in the digital age means creating rules that require governments and businesses to be transparent about how they use our information. This is likely the most important way in which our address of privacy must evolve. Transparency needs to be concise, meaningful, and useful. And while the need for a clear checkbox of consent is, for lawyers, a holy grail on both Atlantic coasts, consumers and their choices far too often fall down the rabbit hole of interminable language as they pull the lever saying, "I agree." This treads upon the notion of what is or isn't truly voluntary under the Katz line of cases and its progeny. I am in full agreement that it is time in the U.S. for adoption of baseline privacy legislation. As Commissioner Brill has said, to close the gaps in consumer privacy protections and help level the playing field among businesses. A key new component, or companion legislation, as the Commissioner highlighted, should require data brokers to provide notice, access, and correction rights to consumers scaled to the sensitivity and use of data at issue. This is an area where Mr. Weitzer also seems to be in agreement. He, in his interview, envisions a world where big databases are audited to prevent abuse, including those of the NSA, and where encryption technology ensures that research involving troves of sensitive personal information don't open windows into individual personal lives. The drive for overarching privacy legislation in the U.S. to supplant or supplement the sector-by-sector approach of our present rules is in no small measure an outgrowth of the current debate over surveillance measures. We don't have to pass judgment on revelations about the NSA to know that these have not only spurred an overdue debate, but also may already be altering the way we think about communication technologies in ways that may take many years to fully realize or understand. For these reasons, I applaud President Obama for welcoming the debate that has developed in the wake of surveillance revelations and his January 17, 2014 speech at the Department of Justice calling for reforms. Congress is considering, but not yet passed, legislation to recommend an end to the NSA's bulk phone metadata collection program in favor of commercial retention of that same data for an 18-month period. This is a duration that most telecommunications providers already retain, and it is expected that the NSA would be required to produce a court order to access it. I also applaud the President for calling for a national conversation about big data sets, because the conversation must not be restricted to government entities. In this regard, I was pleased that Commissioner Brill noted in her speech that leaders within the business community have joined the President in recognizing that rebuilding the trust of individuals is essential to the success of all programs and services, both governmental and commercial, built on big data analytics. These business leaders have urged companies to adopt enhanced privacy protections as a key part of strengthening consumer trust. This is not, however, an area of trust where the U.S. stands alone, with much work to do. I was not at all surprised by Christopher Wolff's revelation in a March 2014 article that European Parliament Rapporteur Jan Philipp Albrecht is also wary of EU member state surveillance tactics. The draft European Parliament report on mass surveillance had contained a directive specifically that the UK, France, Germany, Sweden, the Netherlands, and Poland should clarify the allegations of mass surveillance and their compatibility with EU laws. Several privacy experts in the US have also argued effectively that the US is not alone in terms of its surveillance modes and methods. Though the "everybody's doing it and our law is better" arguments from the US on these issues may not be dispositive of big problems, they certainly have provided a helpful perspective and hopefully tempered some hyperbole. The real danger of surveillance in a state is a person or persons who believes that the broadening of authorized surveillance actions is always morally justified and prudent. It is someone who, perhaps with the best of intentions, can make the most grievous of mistakes with eyes wide open and believe that the ends do justify the means. The maintenance of dignity through privacy is ultimately about defining one's autonomy within a society. is the boundary between the individual and the society. The fact that Adam and Eve were aware of their nakedness and ashamed by it is, in the Christian sense, cited as a byproduct of their original sin. But in a larger sense, their defenses to shame arose from recognition of power, in this example, God's power, and the feeling of smallness in recognition of it, the vastness of their environs and what they did or didn't know. Circumstances had suddenly made them self-aware in a brave new world. Sound familiar? I agree with those taking an extreme view on the death of privacy to the extent that the innovation of the digital age and all that it will do to change and enhance our lives will alter forever how we think about communities and the maintenance of standards. It must. The promise of the digital age and its improvement of society on so many levels has not, however, also metaphorically erased the requisite for dignity. Not even the internet is that creatively destructive. The question of whether and under what circumstances we champion privacy, as a right, as a freedom to be left alone, a concept embodied in an overarching omnibus law, or as merely a protection that we want afforded by the court in response to a harm, raises much larger issues of what kind of society we want to be and how we prioritize our freedoms versus our restrictions. If we truly believe that privacy is lost, then a key component of what makes us human is, as well.